I admire people who are dauntless. I even like the word dauntless. It comes from a root word, daunt. D-A-U-N-T. We don't often use that word, but it means to intimidate, to dishearten, to abate the courage of. A daunting enemy is one that is so intimidating that it drains your heart of all courage. We had a daunting task when in the Gulf War several years ago. We wanted to attack Iraq because of what they had done. They had attacked Yemen. And you remember the strategy was shock and awe. Before the ground troops even entered Iraq, then before that happened, there were planes that would drop these huge bombs on various strategic targets within the country. And the idea was these megaton bombs would be so loud and so destructive, and there'd be so many of them, I mean hundreds and thousands of these, that it would be so daunting to the enemy that they would just shrink in fear. And for the most part, it worked, didn't it? I mean, we rolled right over the country. A daunting enemy can strike fear in your heart, cause you to want to be disheartened. But if you're dauntless, it doesn't matter how loud the shock and how intimidating the awe, you don't lose heart. You're dauntless. The most daunting of all enemies is death. We respect people who can look square in the jaws of death without their hearts melting. There's a poem written about a woman in the 1500s, Mary Ambree, who led a valiant charge against a castle in Spain. She was a captain. She was a woman captain. And all these men followed her into battle, and they won the battle in an amazing way. And the poem says, "When captains courageous whom death could not daunt." That's how the poem starts, about captains courageous. We admire captains courageous who are determined, fearless, dauntless in the face of death. Another person who didn't shrink back against a daunting task was a fellow by the name of George Mallory. Back in 1924, he had the idea of climbing Mount Everest. No one had ever attempted that before. They thought he was crazy. With all of the technology that they had back in the 20s, he was going to attempt to scale this mountain. And they thought, they just couldn't imagine why anybody would want to do that. So they wrote a poem about this. Why seek to scale Mount Everest? They're asking him. Why seek to scale Mount Everest, queen of the air? Why strive to crown that cruel crest and deathward dare? Said Mallory of dauntless quest, because it's there. You've heard that phrase before. I would love to have been there when he first said it. You know, why seek to crown that cruel crest and deathward dare? And Mallory says, I don't know, because it's there. You know, maybe that's the way he said it. Probably he said, no, because it's there. It's something great. I want to achieve this. Unfortunately, he died in the process. It wasn't until 30 years later that Sir Edmund Hillary actually crowned the cruel crest and deathward dare and came back to tell the story. I want to be dauntless like that. However, you know, neither climbing mountains nor fighting battles rev my engine. I want a vision so captivating, so incredibly powerful that it reaches inside my chest, clutches my heart, and makes it pound. I want something that blows my mind with wonder and fills my screen with my mental screen with imagination and amazement. I want a vision of heaven. I want to be dauntless about something beyond this world, something bigger than this world has to offer. I want the same kind of spell to come over me that came over the little mouse in C.S. Lewis, Chronicles of Narnia. Maybe you remember the story of the voyage of the Dawn Treader. In the Chronicles, the great Aslan lion, who's the Christ figure, has come from the east, and he rescues Narnia, and he kicks out the white witch, and then he returns to the east. Well, the characters in the story want to go find Aslan's country, and so they set out on this voyage in a ship called the Dawn Treader. And as the voyage goes through all kinds of adversity and hardship, they make it to the place where the ship cannot go any further. So some of the characters, including Reepicheep, the little mouse, and the children in the story, get in the smaller boat, and they sail further on. And then when that boat can't sail any further, then Reepicheep goes on alone in his own little mouse-sized boat. And earlier in the story, Reepicheep says this, "While I can, I sail east in the dawn treader. When she fails me, I paddle east in my coracle. When she sinks, I shall swim east with my four paws. And when I can swim no longer, if I have not reached Aslan's country or shot over the edge of the world in some vast cataract, I shall sink with my nose to the sunrise." That is a valiant, dauntless little mouse. And I want what he has. It reminds me of Philippians 3:14. "But one thing I do," Paul says, "forgetting what is behind and straining toward what is ahead, I press on with my nose to the sunrise, toward the goal to win the prize for which God has called me heavenward in Christ Jesus." Yearning for Christ's country is our essential hope. It's what can make you dauntless in this life, no matter what adversities may come. It's the only hope that can really satisfy our soul. See, each of us have some kind of hope in our lives. We have a drive, we have a dream, we have a vision. And so often we substitute some other earthly thing for that vision of heaven, thinking that's what we're after. Humans have done that forever. We explore oceans and discover continents and scale mountains. We build submarines that can take us to the depths of the sea. We build spaceships that can put men on the moon. And all these ventures are inspired by an inner yearning to be part of something truly, truly big. And yet time and time again, we read about these men and women. They come back from their incredible adventures, and what happens? They fall into a depression. Some of them even take their own lives. Remember the story of Lewis and Clark and their grand adventure to find the Northwest Passage. When they returned from that incredible, incredible adventure, they fell into a horrible depression. Even the men on the moon have come back. You've read stories and accounts about how they fall into drinking and emptiness. In the cruelest of ironies, some of these captains courageous, whom death could not daunt, succumb to death by their own hand. Why is that true? Because they've tried to satisfy heaven's hunger with earth's food. Although they've accomplished their dream, it tasted sweet at first, but it left them empty. Heaven's hunger in our hearts can only be satisfied by heaven's bread. C.S. Lewis said this in Mere Christianity, "If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world." And so are you. You were made for another world. Heaven. But often we don't really know what it's all about. So today in this morning's time together, my goal is to give you a vision for heaven, so that it puts fire in your soul, a yearning for the world for which you were made. Turn to Colossians chapter 3. Colossians chapter 3. I'm going to give you two principles about heaven, and then we're going to answer three questions. Two principles and three questions. The first principle is in Colossians chapter 3. If you're in the Pew Bible, it's page 834. And I encourage you to follow along. Colossians chapter 3, Paul says this, "Since then you have been raised with Christ, set your hearts on things above." Like that little mouse in C.S. Lewis' story. "Set your hearts on things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God," Christ's country. He says, set your hearts, and then in verse 2, he says, "Set your minds on things above, not on earthly things. For you died, and your life is now hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you will also appear with him in glory." And the first principle is this, is that we often think our true life is here on earth, but our true life is in heaven. My true life is hidden with Christ in God in heaven. That's where my citizenship is. We can enjoy the things of earth as blessings, but always remember where our life is kept. And the reason that nothing on earth really satisfies is because our life is kept in heaven with Christ in God. Let me look at the next principle on Romans 5. Just turn to the left a little bit. Romans chapter 5. Page 798 in your Bible. Not only is my true life kept in heaven, but God has taken a little bit of heaven and he's poured it into my heart. It says in verse 5, Romans 5, 5, and hope does not disappoint us. Now this hope, unlike so many of the earthly hopes that we have that do leave us empty, this hope does not leave us empty because, why? Because God has poured out his love, which comes from him in heaven, poured a little bit of heaven into our hearts by the Holy Spirit whom he's given us. So God's love is in your heart. When you experience Christ's love for you, you are actually tasting the sweet water of God in heaven. And we anchor our hope to that love. Unlike the things of earth, the things of heaven do not disappoint. Johnny Erickson Tada calls this our homing beacon. She says, God's love in my heart serves as a homing beacon. It wants to lead me to its source. So when I've tasted God's love, I want to know where that comes from. That is not like anything in this world. It's from another world. And it's my homing beacon to take me to home. The English novelist George Eliot, who was actually a woman, she named herself George because I guess she was more accepted that way, but good old George Eliot said this, life began with waking up and loving my mother's face. Life began with waking up and loving my mother's face. But imagine if you couldn't see or you couldn't hear. Imagine if you couldn't speak and you knew that your mother's presence was there. But your whole life, you never could see her. You never could hear her voice. But you knew her love was in her, your heart. It was drawing you back to, where is my mother? It's like a story we read to our kids. Are you my mother? You know, but where is this source of love? Imagine never being able to see that. And all of a sudden, the blindness was taken out of your eyes. The deafness was taken out of your ears. And you could wake up and love your mother's face, see your mother's face. It's that love that not only drives us in earthly relationship, it drives us in heavenly relationships too. And when we die and we see God's face, when we see Christ in all of his glory, when we wake up and love our Father's face, what an incredible experience that will be. It's that homing beacon that's driving us onward. So God is he's poured out his little bit of love into my heart. My true life is in heaven, and he's poured out a little bit of that heart and draws me to him. Now, what is heaven like? Now, we want to ask a few questions about it because there's so many distorted ideas about heaven. And I want you to turn to John 14. The first question is this, where is heaven? John 14. 763 in the Pew Bibles, if you want to look on. John chapter 14. The first thing we want to ask is where is it? Where is heaven? Jesus is trying to encourage his disciples toward the end of his ministry there, and he says, do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God. Trust also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. Now, we kind of stop there with the idea of a house, a mansion, a palace, and in our minds there's maybe this celestial thing up above the skies. But don't get caught there. Don't stop there. You know, Jesus, as well as many of the other writers, were trying to give us images to help kind of stir our imagination. But there's so much more than this house with a room in it. You know, okay, where's my room? Okay, number 242. You know, okay, this is my little room. Don't stop there. In my Father's house. The point is, it's my Father's house. It's with my Father, with God. I'm going there to prepare a place for you. We are in Christ's mind. He is preparing something for us, a place. And I'll come back and I'll take you to be with me. I'll take you to your little room. No, I'll take you to me. So the first thing is, where is heaven? Heaven is where God is. The way there is through Christ. You know the way to the place where I am going. Thomas said, Lord, we don't know where you're going, so how can we know the way? He's kind of focusing on where, and Jesus said, well, let's not worry about where, it's me. Jesus answered, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. So where is heaven? It's where Jesus is. It's where God is. The second thing is, heaven is outside of this natural world. Heaven is outside of this natural world. In 2 Corinthians 12, you don't need to turn there, I'll just describe it to you. Paul says that he was actually given a vision in which he was either taken in the body or in the spirit, he doesn't know, to the third heaven. The third heaven was, in the first century, their idea of how to understand the universe was to think of it in terms of three different stages, if you will. The first stage was the skies, where the birds fly, the clouds and everything. Above that was the second stage, or the second heaven, which was the stars and the firmament above them. Now remember, they had no concept of a round earth or orbiting around the sun or anything like that. So it was just kind of these steps, if you will. The first step was the first heaven. The second step was the third heaven, second heaven. And the third step above that, outside of that, was heaven, where God lived. Now, in our world, in our understanding, you know, in fact, it said Christ ascended through the heavens into heaven with God. So the third heaven. Now, our way of understanding our world is come a long way since there. And one of the interesting things that maybe you've read about or read articles on, this whole quantum physics ideas of dimensions. And we know that there are three basic dimensions. The first dimension, the second dimension, two-dimensional object would be flat, you know, there's no depth to it. A three-dimensional object is a cube, there's height, depth, width. And then you add a fourth dimension, which is time. You add that to space, so three dimensions of space and then time. And for the longest time, we thought that was it, basically. But then science is, and this is way over my head, so I'm going to be real quick here. But science and quantum physics has actually discovered that there may be more dimensions than we understand. That when we go to the subatomic level, some of these neutrinos and whatever they're called now, the electrons, neutrinos, gluons or something like that, they're moving through space on a subatomic level that just seems to defy all the ways that we understand dimensions. In fact, there's a theory called string theory where some neutrinos will actually go from this spot to this spot without passing through this spot. And they wonder, how does that happen? Well, there must be other dimensions that we don't even really know about. 5 dimensions, 6 dimensions. They've calculated as many as 10 or 11 dimensions. Some theory go to over 20 dimensions. And even one theory talks about an infinite number of dimensions. Space and time that we don't really understand. We cannot grasp in our human understanding. Well, this tells me, but maybe there's a spiritual dimension. I mean, that really leaves room in my heart, my mind, my imagination, that there could be a dimension out there that we've really never been able to grasp with scientific understanding. They're getting close to it with quantum physics and the subatomic level. But maybe there's something out there that we really don't know. So Paul talked about it as the third heaven. Maybe we can talk about it as the spiritual dimension. So where is heaven? It's where God is. It's outside this natural world and this spiritual dimension. And the second question is, what is it like to be in heaven? Wouldn't you like to know, be able to go and come back? In fact, there's some books that have been written recently about people's experience where they say they've actually gone to heaven and then been resuscitated after death and come back and described it. Well, the one thing that we know from Scripture is what these people tell us, and Paul was one who went to heaven and came back. So he knows a little bit about what it's like. And he says, I heard sounds there that are inexpressible. No eye has seen, no ear has heard what God has prepared for. You just can't even describe it. And so about the best that he's done for us in Philippians chapter 1, and I'll just refer to that as well, Philippians 1, Paul is trying to debate, should I stay on here on earth? He's in prison. He's thinking about death. He's really desiring to go and be with Christ, but yet he wants to stay here to be with people. So he's kind of torn between the two. And he says to me, but to go and be with Christ is better by far. And I love that phrase. It's better by far than what we have on earth. So what is it like to be in heaven? Well, heaven is better than life on earth. And you have to think about all the great things that you're able to experience here on earth. Relationships. You know, go back to, if you're married, your wedding day. That glorious moment when you and your bride or you and your groom were joined together in this incredibly close and intimate relationship. Go back to times with your family members that you've enjoyed. Maybe experiences that you've had to travel around the world and to see things. Maybe some of you have flown in airplanes, and how glorious that is, how wonderful it is to see our world and all it has to offer. Some of the experiences that we've had is just absolutely fantastic. But then when you think that that is just a tiny, tiny bit of the better by far. So multiply the best of human experiences, the peak of humanity, multiply that by thousands, and you get what heaven must be like. Heaven is better than earth, than anything that we can ever describe here. But also turn to 1 Corinthians 13. I want you to see this one. In heaven, we will know so much more than we know here. 1 Corinthians chapter 13. It's page 813 in your pew Bibles. What's heaven like? It's better by far than anything that you can experience here on earth, Paul says. And then Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 13 toward the very end, verse 12, now we see but a poor reflection as in a mirror. A poor reflection as in a mirror. Suppose you were walking down the road and you saw this mirror and it was just kind of a fogged up, dirty, you kind of can barely make out your own face in the mirror. And it's just kind of foggy. You can't see it very well. It says, now we see but a poor reflection in the mirror. Then in heaven, we will see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. So what's heaven like? It's better by far than we can ever experience on earth. And also it's knowing and being known. Knowing and being known. Someone has once said the first expression that we're going to make when we get to heaven is this. Oh, now it makes sense. So you come to heaven, you go, oh, it's like, now I get it. And we've heard the illustration of watching someone, sew a tapestry. And, they can see the front side of it, and you're looking at the back side of it. All you see is these strands of thread coming through. And because of the way that it looks on the back, it just looks like a mess. It's like a poor reflection of what's happening on the other side. And when you get to heaven, all of a sudden you're going to know and be fully known. That tapestry, God's going to turn it around and go, look and see. This is what all that meant. This was what all that was about. All that heartache, you understand now how it weaves together. How those relationships that you thought were failing, that you never really could figure out, this is how I was weaving all this together. So in heaven, you'll know, you'll see, you'll go, oh, now I see. Not only that, you'll be fully known. I think one of the greatest pains in life is loneliness. It's a sense of nobody really knows me. Nobody really understands what I'm going through. Nobody really has taken the time to listen to me, and to climb inside my skin and try to figure out who I am and what I am. I don't even know me. But in heaven, it says, well, the mirror will be all cleaned up. We'll be able to see, we'll be able to know, and we'll be able to see ourselves and be fully known by those around us. One of the greatest things about going to heaven will be the relationships. The relationships that we have that will be completely unhindered. You think you're having a wonderful relationship. You're very close with a friend or a loved one, a family member, a spouse. You're so close, you think you know them. You don't know them at all. When you get to heaven, you're going to see all the wonders of who that person is. They're going to see all the incredible wonders of who God made you to be. You will know and be fully known. But there's one more thing. Turn to Revelation 7. Revelation chapter 7. What is heaven like is by far better than anything on earth. You'll know more than you know here. You'll be fully known. Revelation 7. John has this incredible vision of heaven. And one of the scenes that comes to him is this group of people that are dressed in white robes. And they've been persecuted because of their time on earth. They've been injured. It's almost like they've been let out of a concentration camp from World War II. You've seen some of those images of these gaunt, hurting men and women. Their heads are bowed. Their heads are shaved. They're just limping along. And John sees them. And look at verse 13, verse chapter 7. Then one of the elders asked me, those in white robes, who are they? Where do they come from? And I answered, sir, I don't know. And he said, these are they who have come out of the great tribulation. They have washed their robes. They have made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore, they are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will spread his tent over them. And I think this is an image that we can grab onto for all of our suffering, all of our pain, all of our adversity. And verse 16, it says, never again will they hunger. Never again will they thirst. The sun will not beat down on them, nor any scorching heat. For the Lamb at the center, and that's Jesus, will be their shepherd. So here we have Jesus leading these multitudes of injured, hurting, persecuted Christians, and he's leading them to the throne to meet their Father, their God. For the Lamb at the center of the throne will be their shepherd. He will lead them to the springs of living water, these parched, hurting people. And then you have this incredible scene where God comes down from the throne and he takes, almost like he takes a handkerchief, and he goes up to each one of them and he wipes their tears. And he says, everything's going to be okay. It's going to be all right. You're here now. Each individual person wiping away their pain, wiping away their tears. Isn't that a beautiful image? What's heaven going to be like? It's better by far. We'll know and be known, and it will provide relief and reward. Relief for our suffering and reward for our service. What a moment that will be. But there's one more question I want to ask. Where is it? What's it like? But can we anticipate anything else after we get to heaven? Believe it or not, we can. Turn to 2 Peter chapter 3. 2 Peter, just a few books to the left. In heaven, is that all we're going to look forward to? Is there something else beyond this? 2 Peter chapter 3. Look at verse 12. This is page, I didn't write down the page, 861. Verse 12, Peter says this, as you look forward to the day of God and speed its coming, that day will bring about the destruction of the heavens by fire, and the elements will melt in the heat. But in keeping with his promise, we are looking forward to a new heaven and a new earth, the home of righteousness. Revelation 21 says, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. In 1 Timothy, Paul says, in this way they lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so that they may take hold of the life that is truly life. There is a new heaven and a new earth. All of the energy that was put into by God to create the first heaven and the first earth, that was corrupted, his original creation. He's been working out a plan, not to bring us to heaven, but to do a restoration project on his original work. He's going to create a new heaven and a new earth, a place that is far greater, far more glorious than what we can ever imagine in this current earth that's been. And the Bible talks about it being in labor pains, yearning for that day. The earth is yearning for that day when it's going to be recreated. Everything at first will be wiped away, clean slate, and then God is going to, with just a word, create a new universe for us to enjoy. Now, that's not the only thing that we're going to look forward to in heaven. We're going to look forward to a special body to enjoy that new creation in. Turn to 1 Corinthians 15. 1 Corinthians chapter 15. The problem is flesh and blood, this current body that we're sitting in these pews with, this earthly tent, it cannot inherit this new creation that God is going to make. Not only do we anticipate God recreating his original creation, making it perfect and credible, we will anticipate a body to match the recreated universe. Verse 42, 1 Corinthians 15, verse 42, he says, so it will be with the resurrection of the dead. The body that is sown is perishable, it is raised imperishable. Paul draws an illustration here, a connection here between our current body, our flesh and blood, and a seed. When we bury our body after death, it's like planting a seed in the ground. In fact, one of the things that we do at a graveside service is that we try to imagine what it's like to bury not only this body, but we're burying a seed in the ground. And the seed has to die, but there's all kinds of potential for that seed. It has to be buried, and then it's going to come back to life. It's going to bloom. It's going to blossom. So what was planted is perishable, but when it comes to life, it is imperishable. It is sown in dishonor. It is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness. It is raised in power. It is sown a natural body. It is raised a spiritual body. And then look at the next few verses, starting in verse 50. Paul says, I declare to you, brothers, that flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God, nor does the perishable inherit the imperishable. He said, I tell you a mystery. We will not all sleep, but we will all be changed in a flash, in the twinkling of an eye at the last trumpet. For the trumpet will sound, the dead will be raised imperishable, and we will be changed. For the perishable must clothe itself with imperishable, and the mortal with immortality. And when the perishable has been clothed with imperishable, and the mortal with immortality, then the saying that is written will come true. Death has been swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your sting? O death, where is your victory? See, there's going to be one funeral service that someone has said, and I love this, the way they say it. There's going to be one funeral service that we're all going to want to attend. It's the funeral service where death is put into the ground. Death dies forever. God's creation is recreated, and we are given a body to enjoy that creation. Aren't you looking forward to that? Is that starting to build something in your soul? I mean, is there something about that that is just connecting with whatever it is that God has poured into your life to say, I want that. That's so incredible. I can't wait to experience that. Is there a requirement? You know, how do I know for certain that I will experience that in the future? Is there a requirement? I want you to turn to chapter 11 of the Gospel of John, and I want you to see this. John chapter 11. Now, we have so many crazy ideas about heaven. Sometimes, you know, kind of our jokes emerge from that. So I can't help but tell a heaven joke. A lady suffered from illness for many years, and she and her husband are at the very end, and she's holding his hand, and she slips away. She dies. And she immediately goes into, you know, heaven, and there's this gate, which we always imagine in heaven, this gate, and there's St. Peter. And St. Peter says, oh, we've kept our eyes on you. We've been looking forward to you coming here. And she says, oh, I can't wait to experience all that heaven has to offer. And Peter says, well, there's one thing you have to do. And she says, oh, what's that? She says, Peter says, well, you have to spell a word. Spell a word? Oh, my goodness. Well, what's the word? And Peter says, spell love. So she said, oh, well, L-O-V-E. Oh, come on in. So she comes into heaven and she explores all that heaven, you know, like we all imagine, floating around in clouds and halos and harps and wings and all this sort of thing. It's a joke, right? We got to play it out. So about a year later, she comes back by the gate she first came in, and there's Peter, you know, sitting by the gate. And Peter says, man, I've been here so long. Do you mind giving me a break? Why don't you stand here and wait? Probably no one will come. Don't worry about it. I'll be back in 15 minutes. So she's standing there by herself waiting, and she looks off in a distance, and lo and behold, here comes her husband. So he comes up to the gate, and she says, oh, wow, I can't believe that it's you. He says, well, how have you been doing since I died? And her husband says, well, you know, that really cute nurse that you had, well, about 3 weeks after we got married and we cashed in your life insurance, and that was supposed to pay for the college for our kids, and we sold the house and we sold all your mother's jewelry, and we just have been all over the world. This last year has been fantastic. My new young bride, we went to Paris and to Spain and to the Orient and everything we always dreamed of doing. Well, it's been incredible. I'm exhausted. I was running with the bulls in Spain when, well, I don't know. I guess I'm not as quick as I used to be. So here I am. So he says, he looks over the gate and he says, well, that looks fantastic. He says, well, how do you get in there? And she says, well, you have to spell a word. And he says, oh yeah, what's the word? She says, spell Czechoslovakia. C-H, no, Z, yeah. We laugh at that, but you know, for many folks, that's about the extent of their understanding of heaven. Getting into heaven requires me to pass some sort of test. I don't know what it is, but I hope it works out. It's like my daughter took the ACT just yesterday. You can't study for the thing. You just hope, you know, you hope you get in there and you do the best you can. You hope for the best. Is that what hope is all about? But that's about as much as people have. John chapter 11 gives us a reassurance. Gives us a hope that is grounded in truth. Gives us something that we know for certain. John chapter 11, verse 25. Jesus said to this woman, and he's in a cemetery, and she's weeping because she lost a loved one. And he says to her, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live, even though he dies. And whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? And that's the question for us today. Do you believe this? Do I believe that Jesus bore the judgment for my sin, that he is the one who is God in the flesh, who will recreate this universe someday? He spoke it into existence in the beginning, and he will speak it again into existence far better, will give me a resurrection body to enjoy that for all eternity. Do I believe that? I want to close with a story of written by a fellow by the name of Joseph Bailey. He wrote a book after three of his children had died. The book is called A View from the Hearse. And he wrestled with whether he should write this book because he was struggling with grief. Three of his four children had died. One of them was not even 5 years old, died of leukemia. So he writes his story in this book, The View from a Hearse, and he recounts going to, after his son had died, they had just had the service the day before, and he goes to the doctor who had cared for his son with leukemia to say thank you for the care that you've given. And he recounts this scene in the doctor's office. He says, a few years ago, I was waiting to see Dr. Woolman, hematologist at Philadelphia Children's Hospital. The day before, we had buried our almost 5-year-old who had died of leukemia. Now I was waiting to thank the man who had been so kind to our little boy and to us during the 9 months between diagnosis and death. Dr. Woolman's secretary beckoned to me. When I approached her desk, she did not tell me, as I expected, that the doctor would now see me. Instead, she looked toward a little boy playing on the floor. In my preoccupation, I had even failed to notice he was there. She whispered, "He has the same problem that your little boy had." I sat down next to the little boy's mother. We were far enough away from him and talked softly enough so that he couldn't hear us. It's hard bringing him here in every 2 weeks for the tests, isn't it? I didn't ask a question. I just stated the fact. It's hard bringing him here every 2 weeks for the tests. The uncertainty whether a child is still in remission or the fearful cells will reappear under the microscope makes the mind run wild. Hard hard. I die every time. And now he's beginning to sense that something's wrong, she said, her voice trailing off. It's good to know, isn't it? I spoke slowly, choosing my words carefully. It's good to know that even though the medical outlook is hopeless, we still have hope for our children in such a situation. We can be sure that after our child dies, he'll be completely removed from sickness and suffering and everything like that, and be completely well and happy. The woman replied, "If I could only believe that. But I don't. I don't. When he dies, I'll just have to cover him up with dirt and forget I ever had him." She turned back to watch her little boy push a toy car on the floor. "I'm glad I don't feel that way," he said. "Why?" This time she didn't turn toward me. She just kept watching her child. "Well, because we covered our little boy up with dirt yesterday afternoon. I'm just here to thank Dr. Woolman for his kindness." She said, "You look like a rational person." I was glad she didn't say, "Oh, I'm sorry." She was looking straight at me. "How can you possibly believe that the death of a man or a little boy is any different than the death of an animal?" "You look like a rational person. How can you believe in all this stuff?" Some of you today may be thinking that. And believe me, I completely respect your view. I'm glad you're here. The journey of faith sometimes takes twists and turns we don't know. But Jesus is offering you hope. Hope not only for this life, but hope for the life to come. And he's saying, "I bore the judgment that you deserve so that you could believe in me and have heaven for all eternity." Won't you do that today?